This is the Education Exchange. I am Paul Peterson, Senior Editor of Education Next. Thank you for joining us. Students lost ground during the COVID pandemic. Is there any way to catch up? Well, some people say tutoring is the one and only way to do it. The U.S. Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, says that we need to give every child that fell behind during the pandemic at least 30 minutes per day, three times per week with a well-trained tutor. And the federal government's followed up with making available $2 billion to school districts to be used for tutoring, maybe even more than that, either during the school day or after school or in the summer. So, and I have to admit that I'm a tutor fan. I don't really think you can learn anything that's really, really difficult to learn, like playing tennis, or which I've never learned properly. Or the violin, which my granddaughter is learning every day, making enormous progress, but couldn't have made progress without a tutor. So I've just seen the reality that tutoring can be very important for learning at least some subjects. But is it really necessary for math and reading? Does it really work? Is it anything better than other options that are out there? So I'm really pleased to have with me today Beth Schuler, a professor of education at the University of Virginia, to discuss this topic. She has brought together, along with two colleagues at Brown University, the team has brought together the best evidence available from across the world on tutoring. And their study is tentatively entitled Towards Effective and Sustainable Tutoring at Scale in the Post-COVID Era, a Meta-Analysis. So, thank you, Beth, for joining me on the Education Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul. I'm excited to be here.
So, Beth, you brought together a fantastic body of information, but why did you decide to do a meta-analysis? Why didn't you just do your own study of tutoring? And why did you decide to look at all these studies that are out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I, you know, as you mentioned, this project is in collaboration with Matt Kraft and Grace Falken at Brown. And so we had been interested in this question, prior to the pandemic. And part of my interest in the topic, you know, a lot of my work has focused on efforts to improve low performing schools and districts. And I sort of started to notice that kind of high dosage tutoring or other kind of small group programs designed to individualize instruction seem to be a common component of some of the most effective reform efforts to kind of improve these low performing systems. So I had, you know, I had been interested in the topic and, you know, for that reason. And we were, even prior to the pandemic, interested in this sort of fundamental challenge, which is that, you know, students have really different learning needs. They are going to require, as you kind of teed up nicely here, differentiation to really maximize their learning, but individualized instruction is going to be really resource intensive. So we were interested in, is it possible to, you know, how can we go about kind of democratizing access to individualized instruction within the kind of public education system in a way that, you know, so that students, it's not just the students whose parents can kind of afford these services that have access to them. And how can we do that while sort of maintaining the effectiveness of these programs?
So you're sort of saying you're looking at how effective can this program be with young people who are having difficult learning. And what did you find? When you look at all of these studies, you put them all together, what's the simple number summing up everything without taking into account any of the details? We'll get into that. But what's the impact of a few hours of tutoring?
Yeah, so we end up, you know, including about 300 studies, 2,500 estimates in our meta-analysis. And we, you know, thought that was useful because it allowed us to kind of examine, as you mentioned, some variation in the effects that we think are relevant to answering this question about democratization. But
what was the number? Beth? Give me a number.
But before we get to that variation, the kind of big picture pooled estimate, we find something, on the order of almost 0.4 standard deviation units. That's the kind of pooled effect.
Standard deviations. How much is that?
That's huge. I mean, you know, anyone who does education research will, you know, if I saw that number kind of come across my output, and I would make sure I didn't make a mistake, right? That's a really big number. It's, you know, similar to the size of, you know, the gain that the average kind of, depending on the estimate you use, the average sort of elementary school student makes over the course of an entire school year. It's more than two times the size of the average kind of impact from an educational intervention that's been evaluated by a randomized control trial. So that's a really big estimate.
So, and that's after, on average, how many hours of tutoring?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head what the mean hours are. I have to look that up. But you know, it varies a lot. And that's one of the things we look at, is whether dosage kind of predicts impacts. And it does seem like the programs that provide a greater number of hours to students seem to generate
large. But you're not talking like, you know, a full day of tutoring. You're talking about, you know, maybe 60 hours over the stretch of several weeks or a couple months, something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so most of these programs are happening, you know, they're like a few sessions a week, maybe, you know, 30 minutes to an hour per session. And it could be for just, you know, a few weeks, or it could be over the course of a school year. But it's not like this is, you know, like you said, full day one-on-one.
Now, the other thing about your analysis that we really should bring out is that these are all randomized trials, correct? These are all situations. Well, explain to our audience what you do when you have a randomized trial.
Sure. So, I mean, we only include randomized control trials, which really allow you to more credibly isolate the kind of causal impact of the program or policy that you're evaluating. And that's because if you just compare kids who did and didn't participate in tutoring, if, you know, say tutoring is opt-in, what you worry about is you can't just compare the outcomes of those two groups of students, because the kids who opted to participate are probably different than the kids who don't opt to participate in ways that explain their outcomes, regardless of whether
it's like in medical research, isn't it? You've got a pill, you got a placebo. Some people get the pill, some people get the placebo, but they're picked at random. And so you can compare the two groups, right? You can compare the test group with the control group, but you can pretty much assume that the students themselves who got into the program are just like those that they're being compared to who didn't get into the program.
Exactly. So this is like our social science version of a medical trial.
So, but, you know, a lot of people worry about those randomized trials because they say, well, that's unfair. Why do some kids get the treatment and other kids don't get it? Tutoring is something that everybody thinks is a good deal. So how can you deny this to some students when you're giving it to others?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, many of these RCTs were probably implemented in contexts where there was not enough funding, as I mentioned, right? Individualized instruction is very resource intensive, so not enough funding to provide tutoring universally to all students. And so I think the counter argument is, well, you know, maybe randomizing access is in some sense the most fair way to determine who gets an opportunity to experience that individualized instruction. And I think the second, you know, answer I would give is that if it's really an opportunity for learning, you know, if we don't know, and a lot of these programs were designed to test different programs, different kind of models of tutoring. And if we don't know whether that model works yet, in some sense, it's, you know, it's the most ethical thing to do to actually set this up in a way where we can learn from that program implementation to figure out what is actually effective before we scale it up to a larger group of students.
Well, I definitely do agree with you. And it is amazing that you did find overall such a big impact. But I know what your study is mainly focused on is what happens when you scale it, when you go from a small scale program to a large scale program. So can you tell me how you looked at what happens when you scale up an intervention like tutoring?
Yeah, we were really interested in this puzzle that it seemed like, you know, there had been some prior reviews of tutoring evidence and our own work that shows really large, as, you know, we've already discussed, impacts of tutoring on student academic achievement, but especially in the kind of post-COVID era, it seemed to be some suggestive evidence and anecdotal evidence that when these programs had been taken to scale, the impacts had sort of fallen short of our kind of highest expectations. So what we're trying to do in this project is understand what are more realistic expectations for the impacts of tutoring on academic achievement when you kind of try to scale them as part of the US public education.
So let's say you've got the really small one. What do you mean by a really small one? Is that just where you have four groups of kids and, you know, just the one tutor and they work with different kids and then you got a comparison group? Is that what you mean by a small scale program?
So we found a real range of programs in terms of their size. And one thing that we find is that a lot of these big, a lot of the big estimate, that 0.4 standard deviation estimate, is really seems to be driven by a subset of these programs that were implemented with like 40 or fewer students. So, you know, small treatment groups. And a lot of them were actually concentrated in kind of elementary school literacy. So, you know, when you look at the bigger programs that are targeting groups of like 100 students or more, you still find, and I don't want this to get lost, and, you know, you still find large, meaningful, positive impacts of tutoring, but they're quite a bit smaller, about half the size of that pooled estimate, when you sort of narrow the focus down to these larger programs.
Well, I was discussing this finding that you get twice as big of an effect if you only have 40 students participating or less than that, as compared to if you've got 100 students participating in. And I discussed it with my wife and she said, well, why should that make any difference? If you've got the same ratio of tutors to students, just because you've got more people involved in the project, why would that mean that you don't have as big enough? Why do you have only half as big of an effect just because you're making this opportunity available to more people? So what's your answer to that question?
Yeah, I don't know if we have an answer that's going to be particularly satisfying to your wife, but I don't know that we can answer affirmatively why that is the case. But what I can tell you is we've ruled some things out. So we were able to code a number of features of these studies and the interventions that were under evaluation in these studies. And so, you know, we do something called meta-regression, where we're basically not just generating pooled estimates of the outcomes, but kind of testing whether different features of the studies or features of the interventions seem to predict bigger test score effects as a result of these reforms. And so we find that this result where the, you know, you see larger effects for studies with smaller samples, that's robust even after we sort of try to control for things like, you know, the subject being taught, the grade level, whether a researcher designed assessment was used or a standardized test was used, whether it was an in-person program, the kind of ratios, the student-teacher ratios, whether the program was held in school, and a number, you know, the tutor type, the dosage.
But you're telling me all the things that don't explain it, but I want to know what does. That was the question.
Yeah, I mean,
he asked me this question. I didn't have an answer. So why do you not get the same results when you have a lot more people engaged in it? What's going off?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is in some ways not that surprising of a finding, in that we see this phenomenon in not just in education policy, but other policy realms as well, where once you sort of, you know, when you implement the kind of Cadillac version of the program, the kind of boutique smaller version with the like really gung-ho tutors and educators, that, you know, the first time around you tend to see bigger impacts than when you try to again bring it to scale with a larger group, with, you know, maybe teachers who are getting, you know, kind of pulled into this as opposed to those who were the most interested at the beginning. Now, of course, this is all kind of speculative. We don't have a ton of data to really sort of definitively pin this down. But I think, you know, that's part of the challenge here, right, is like bringing a program to scale. And how do you staff that program and, you know, without sort of losing the efficacy.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions about how widespread is tutoring around the country in light of the attempt to recover from COVID. I mentioned the U.S. Secretary of Education at the beginning, but are the states taking up this idea? Are they really behind this idea of tutoring?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a case that in some ways is, you know, there's been almost a shocking degree of kind of consensus around this as a really important and suitable policy approach to addressing disrupted learning, and a pretty widespread offering of tutoring through, you know, new federal funding sources. And then there are a number of statewide programs to try to bring this to scale. So really widespread offerings. But then, you know, if you look at, there's some interesting data from the Institute of Education Sciences from the U.S. Department of Education, where they surveyed schools. And so in, this is in 2023, most recently. So 80% of schools, of public schools, report providing some tutoring. But then there's variation in the kinds of tutoring that they're providing. So only about 37% say they're providing what they are considering high dosage tutoring, which tends to be, you know, researchers kind of think of as more the gold standard type of programming.
So what's high dosage? Is high dosage 3 times a week, or is it 7 weeks, or what do they mean by high dosage?
Yeah, so at least 3 times a week, and then you're getting a certain, you know, number of hours per session, kind of sustained over over several weeks. So and also the ratios have to be low. So you're in a kind of small group with you know, maybe 2 or 3 students at max. And that's, you know, one of the things we wanted to kind of look at empirically is to try to, and something we're still trying to disentangle, is which kind of components of high dosage tutoring are really responsible.
Well, does it make any difference if you have a 1-to-1 tutor, or if it's 1-to-2, or 1-to-5, or 1-to-10? How small does the tutoring session? Basically, this is my view of it. It's got to be 1-to-1, because I've been in 1-to-4 tennis sessions that are totally worthless. I don't learn a thing. 1-to-8 is even, it's dreadful. It's I go backwards. So it's got to be 1-to-1, or maybe 1-to-2. So what do you find?
Yeah. So, you know, and again, I think we're still kind of really trying to pin these results down, but preliminarily it looks like we find similarly large impacts for 1-to-1 tutoring and 2-to-1 tutoring. Somewhat smaller impacts when you have a slightly higher ratio, like, you know, three or more students per tutor. But again, I don't want to lose
sight of that. Absolutely right. Don't walk away from that finding. I can prove that finding. I've seen it happen on the tennis court many a time. Why should it be different for math and reading?
Well, we still do see large impacts for these small group programs, even if you got 3 or 4 students per tutor. So not as big of an impact as 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, but, you know, but still meaningful. So I just don't want, you know, us to make kind of perfect the enemy of the good here.
All right. I know, I'll concede that. Maybe you learn a little bit if it's 4-to-1. but how about 10-to-1? Can that work?
So we don't really have the power to detect, you know, kind of differences at that level with this sample. Although I will say that there's a model I've done some research on in the past called the Vacation Academies model that's been used in, it was originated in Massachusetts, but has been used elsewhere as well. So, you know, I think there is some rigorous evidence in support of some of these sort of small group programs where, you know, you've got, especially if you've got a certified teacher that is capable of kind of the classroom management and differentiation piece that's necessary for a small group, as opposed, which might not be as necessary in a 1-to-1 tutoring setting. So I don't think
in terms of the qualifications of the tutor, does it make any difference if it's a college student or if it's actually, you know, a fully licensed teacher that supposedly has had a course in training in how to teach? How much difference does that make?
Yeah, so again, I'll characterize these results as kind of preliminary, and we're still poking at them and trying to break them. And but at least for the moment, what we're finding are similar size effects for certified teachers, for paraprofessionals, and for college or graduate students, and larger effects for those groups than, for example, peer tutors, so like other K-12 students tutoring their K-12 peers, or there's this other category of other community members that don't fall into the bucket of teachers, paraprofessionals. Well,
that is sort of interesting, because I've always thought that probably any good college educated person can become an effective teacher, that there's probably not much difference between a certified teacher and any college student on average. I know that there's a lot of variation in both of them. But I also thought that maybe peer-to-peer might work, though we have don't have that much evidence. So you find that peer-to-work is, how is that at all affected?
We do find descriptively positive, pretty large positive effects, although when you kind of control, one of the tricky empirical challenges about trying to isolate the causal effect of a particular program characteristic, right, is that many of these program characteristics might be correlated with each other in ways that make it difficult to kind of isolate the contribution of that program characteristic. So just to give an example, maybe for say that all the virtual tutoring programs use volunteer tutors. Well, that's going to make it really hard to tease apart. Is it, are the effects smaller for virtual because it's virtual or because it's, using volunteer tutors? So we try to use this meta-regression approach to address that to some extent by saying, okay, well, what if we look at, how virtual is related to effects controlling for all these other program characteristics?
So on the peer-to-peer, what do you find? Do you find much of an effect at all or not much?
Yeah, we do find positive effects, but they're just smaller than the impacts that we see for certified teachers, paraprofessionals, and college or graduate students.
You mentioned online learning, and that is hard to isolate the effect of that, but a lot of people have been raising questions about the effectiveness of online learning, but maybe tutoring is the one thing you can do online, because you could have a one-to-one relationship of a teacher and a student online, and they can interact with one another, and it's a more real engagement than it is with these sort of larger classes where you have a passive response by your audience out there. So what do you find with the online tutoring?
Yeah, so we find smaller impacts, still positive effects on average, but quite a bit smaller for the virtual programs than the in-person programs. That said, I do want to, sort of encourage caution in interpreting those results, in part because, we really have a small literature base around virtual tutoring. So our sample includes fewer than 10 studies that are evaluating virtual tutoring programs, whereas, we've got hundreds that are evaluating in-person program. So a really small literature that's ripe for, we need more evidence in this area for sure, in part because that's one of the sort of strategies that districts are and states are using to try to scale this approach. And the other thing I'll say is that the studies that we do include on virtual tutoring, almost all of them come from a kind of post-COVID onset context. And some of them were implemented in the middle of the real kind of emergency, pandemic emergency. So it's hard to know how much the results of those studies generalize to kind of more typical times, given those programs were being implemented in the middle of a lot of chaos and disruption to people's lives.
Is there a maximum amount of tutoring that you don't get much benefits beyond that? Do you have any sense of that from your data?
Yeah, it does look like you see kind of larger effects for, a greater number of hours up to 60 or more hours. Then it doesn't seem like, it seems like you're kind of getting diminishing returns there. So, and that's kind of over the course of the entire program. So potentially, suggestive evidence that maybe there's kind of diminishing returns at that point. But in general, we see more does seem to be more.
So what I get from your study overall is that some of the claims for tutoring are a little bit overblown. The 0.4 may be a little, exaggerated when you start thinking about how this would work on a large scale basis. But even if you scale this, think about this for a bit, you still might get at least half that or somewhere in the neighborhood of half that from a fairly substantial tutoring program, which is really very, very good when you start comparing it. I mean, that's almost as good as class size reduction from 24 to 16, according to the famous Tennessee class size reduction study. So if you can get with a tutoring program of, a few hours a week over a reasonably short period of time, that's a huge impact. Isn't that the saying?
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think, an effect of 0.2 standard deviations is really substantial and can make a big difference for students, especially, one thing that we find is that these impacts seem to be pretty consistent across different grade levels, across subjects, and across program characteristics. So we do see some program design features that seem to be associated with bigger effects, but even some of the like less desirable program design characteristics are still associated with meaningful positive impacts. And so that's actually, I kind of find these results sort of encouraging, that even when you sort of think about a more kind of realistic and policy relevant estimate of the impact of these programs, they're still, a really promising, I think, approach to trying to address some of the learning disruptions and kind of inequities.
You don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. So just because it's not perfect, it can still be good. That's what I hear you saying. But now I'm going to ask you a question. If it's so good, then why are only 11% of students participating in tutoring programs? I think that was a percentage that you gleaned from what has been said out there by school districts. 11% of our students are actually participating in a tutoring program. That's sort of a sad commentary. Effective program. We had across the board learning loss out there, especially for disadvantaged students, but across the board, and yet only 11% are willing to be participating in a tutoring program. So why?
So, I can't say definitively, but I have some ideas about it, some theories. One would be that I think, my sense anecdotally is that a lot of these districts and states are providing tutoring on a sort of opt-in basis, right? And so it may be the case that the students who could benefit the most from the programs aren't the ones who necessarily show up and participate. I think schools are also reporting challenges in terms of the labor market to hire tutors to participate in these programs, and the schools that are serving high concentrations of low-income students report even more intensive problems. So we've got, challenges with kind of hiring and retaining tutors. You've got administrative turnover, which can be a challenge if administrators are the ones kind of coordinating these programs and running them. And then also I think there's some sort of uncertainty that's created around the kind of end of the federal ESSER relief funding that was provided in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic and has funded a lot of these programs. I think that's creating some kind of uncertainty about whether to, how widespread should we make these programs if the funding is not going to be there in the long run to continue them. So a lot of challenges for scaling, I think.
Well, thank you, Beth. This has been an illuminating discussion about a very important effort to overcome some of the learning loss that the country has suffered in the last few years. So thank you for joining me on the Education Exchange.
Thanks. It's fun to talk with you about this puzzle.
Well, I have been speaking with Beth Schuler, the professor of education at the University of Virginia. She's co-author of a forthcoming paper tentatively entitled Towards Effective and Sustaining Tutoring at Scale in the Post-COVID Era. The study is also by Matthew Kraft and by Grace Falcon, both at Brown University. I am Paul Peterson. This is the Education Exchange. Please join me for an Education Exchange podcast on the EducationX website, released every Monday at noon Eastern Time.